Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
Well, we're opening this week with an email from Richard, and specifically wanted to also say hello to IS Arc company in Northern Ireland, who it turns out listen to the podcast in their office. When we did the survey a few weeks ago, one of the things I wanted to learn was how many downloads does a single person generate. It turns out that most people only download the show on one device, which is great. But Richard wrote in and did also let me know that maybe some people download the show once and play it to an office, or maybe their kids have it played in their computer science GCC classes, both of which it turns out are true. So if you're playing the podcast to your office, I'd love to know.
I was really excited by this. I don't know why. I think it was because I quite like the idea that people are, you know, like that's a whole office full of people who are presumably all happy to listen to our aimless ranting and twittering on Sundays. They obviously don't listen on a Sunday, but it's quite nice to know that, we're being treated much like a radio, and I find that immensely satisfying.
I apologise to the one person in the office who doesn't like listening to Ian and I. You have my sympathies. I have to listen to Ian a lot more than you do, though, and he has to listen to me a hell of a lot more than you do, so you've got off easy. Anyway, Richard did write in with an email relevant to last week's show, where we were talking about BT and spam calls and alternatives to landlines. And I'm going to trim the email ever so slightly, but I did think this point was worth making. Richard says, I must confess to being very skeptical of BT's claims to have helped eliminate spam calls to landlines. They have done a wonderful job of eliminating junk from UK numbers by signing up to the blocking scheme. But as a business, we used to get 10 to 20 junk calls every day from unknown or very obviously fake numbers, and a large number of international numbers. Despite years of asking BT to block these calls, they claim that they cannot block any international calls due to international treaties regarding calls between countries. They can block our number from making calls to international numbers, but not block international numbers from calling us. So he said they also switched to a voice over IP line, which has been much better because they can block international numbers. And that intrigued me no end, because that's what you, Ian, said last week that you did. You got a VoIP line too, which just makes me think VoIP is still the future, which to me, the word VoIP makes me think of the word Vonage, which makes me think of 2006.
It's interesting because I've always thought one of the big mistakes that Skype made was not offering, even if it was a sort of parallel service, was offering some sort of Skype service. I was thinking about using Skype. I thought, oh, what a good idea. I could just have a Skype line, and it would be like a VoIP line, and I'd be able to call normal numbers and et cetera and have a phone number. But they don't offer any functionality with hardware. So unless you get a very specific Skype phone, you can't have a phone in your house that is connected to Skype, not easily. Whereas VoIP is much more widely supported. And in fact, if you want, you can just have a little box that you plug normal phones into, and they're just turned into VoIP phones by this little piece of hardware. So I've always thought that was a sort of missed business opportunity for Skype. Skype could have been this huge global phone provider, but they just sort of won't do it because they like to have their proprietary little system, and it isn't compatible with a proper standard.
Well, this has prompted a wonderful conversation. If you want to prompt a wonderful conversation, you can also do as Richard did and send an email to podcast@natelangson.com. We love to hear your emails. You can even send us voice attachments if you wish. We have had a couple of people do it recently, but for various programmatic reasons, we weren't able to use them. But that is something that I want to try and do a little more of. So you can always record stuff and send them to us there. And if you're playing this to an office and you want us to say hello to your office, we're very willing. I think this introduction has proved just how willing we are to do that. We're also willing to talk about the week's news, so let's do that. And in fact, let's do it now. Let's do it right now. There's a little musical pause there, so when I said right now, what I really meant was right now. after the musical bumper. So you're soon going to be able to get Sky TV without having a satellite dish. This is huge news. Kate, my fiance, and I were driving yesterday to... it doesn't matter where we're going to. We were driving. And I noticed one of the big, old, fat, analog satellite dishes on the side of somebody's house. I said, God, what an eyesore they were in the 90s and the 80s and before they moved to digital. But now it seems that these things are going to be completely irrelevant. We're moving towards a dish-free future. Very exciting. Sky is planning to make its TV service, which is nearly 300 channels, I think it's about 280 channels, available without a satellite dish. They're going to move the whole distribution service over to broadband connections as an option. It's not a complete replacement. It's going to be an option. And the option allows Sky to sell TV to about 2 million new households in the UK, or 6 million households across Europe who don't have a satellite dish. That's according to The Guardian. On a broad level, obviously, this would make it a far more similar service to Virgin Media, which delivers broadband and television down a single cable. But there are some huge nuances, which obviously we're going to discuss shortly, such as whether this would require fiber optic cable or be limited to Sky's broadband package, whether it would consume regular bandwidth shared with your family's internet activity, or whether it would use, as Virgin does, a separate channel of data. You know, whether HD and 4K would be supported, because they're hugely dependent on the speed of your internet. So we'll discuss that in a little bit. But all this came up during Sky's recent earnings report, in which the CEO of Sky, Jeremy Darroch, said, quote, "We have exciting plans in place to launch our Sky TV service in the UK without the need for a satellite dish. For the first time, opening up the full Sky TV service to millions of customers who either don't currently want or can't have a dish installed." He goes on and says, launching in our next financial year, so that's 2018, and initially in the UK, this broadband-based service will open up headroom for growth. Over time, we will launch this service in our other markets, so across Europe, building on our position as Europe's leading OTT, or over-the-top provider. So this is very interesting for us as consumers, but the timing is crucial also for Sky. It had an 18% fall in its profits just for the UK business in the second half of last year, and a lot of that obviously is to do with the ridiculous cost of bidding for sports, competing with BT, but also we've just got such an insanely rampant competitive market at the moment that it's really costing companies a lot of money just to keep their head above water. So, Ian, before we move on and discuss some of the nuances, what was your takeaway to this? Does this feel inevitable?
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose it does. I can envisage a time when we will rely on some form of... I suppose delivering stuff over the internet is a complicated thing. And I guess what I'm trying to get at here, really, is that everything will eventually be delivered via IP, I suppose. I mean, it just feels like that's the way things are going. It's efficient. You can put it over. You could put it over the air, or you could put it through, you know, traditional mobile networks, or you can put it on a cable. But I think the point is that we're sort of moving from a more traditional broadcast system to a much more IP-based system. So it isn't a massive surprise to me this is coming. I'll give you some examples of why I think it's sort of happening sort of now-ish. I think Now TV has obviously given Sky a lot of valuable data about how people consume TV and about the feasibility of delivering video over the internet. So they've obviously learned a lot from that project. Also, if you look at Sky Q, you know that I have a box in my lounge that receives Sky signals from a Sky satellite, and I then have a second box here in the study where I record the podcast with you, and it uses a streaming system. I believe it's called... Now, Sky is a contributor to this project, and it's called SAT-IP. Now, they don't obviously mention it at all in any of their literature. They don't talk about how they do their stuff, but they were very involved in the development of that. And a couple of years ago, companies like Elgato had little satellite receivers that would enable you to sort of stream out to compatible boxes. But it enables you to do everything that you would do on a normal satellite box, but just at the end of a Wi-Fi connection or an Ethernet cable. So all the encryption remains in place and is just handled by the box itself. So it's almost like they were just sort of taking what they've learned from the Sky Q thing and then moving that onto an internet delivery system. And my Sky box sends me 720p to my TV in here, and the quality is amazing. So if they can achieve that sort of thing on the internet, then it'll be pretty cool, I reckon.
It's obviously the way that all this is going, because realistically, installing something as cumbersome as a satellite dish on the side of your house and having it beam television from space, probably not as easy long term as just delivering it down a fiber optic cable. And it is likely, I think, that this would only be delivered down fiber optics. You know, you could do it over DSL, but the wildly fluctuating nature of speeds over copper wiring would make it a very poor to piss poor service at best. So I think it's safe to assume this would be a fiber package. I think it's also probably safe to assume that this would be something that would be sold as a, at least initially, as a all Sky package. So you would sign up to Sky Fiber and you get it. You probably won't be able to sign up to Virgin Fiber and then tack on a Sky package on top. Yeah. Although maybe you would. Maybe that's...
No, I'll tell you why I don't think you would be able to. I think it's going to come down to the fact that they're going to need to have such a high level of quality assurance on the lines that it'll only be something they can manage internally. You know, this isn't sort of Netflix we're talking about. Like, I mean, Netflix is quite good. Looks pretty good on all connections. But if you're a broadcaster, you want to be able to assure people that they're getting a broadcast quality service. And, you know, as much as I love Netflix, it doesn't give any such assurance. You know, you might get really good quality or you might get really bad quality. Depends on your line. And I can't see a way to really do this properly without it being a Sky end-to-end solution.
I think you're almost certainly right. And there are some other things that we have to factor in. You know, for one thing, if you're talking about standard def content for a single TV, that's not ridiculously difficult to do down copper. But if you're doing multi-room, HD, and by 2018, you know, the entirety of this year and part of next year, it's likely we'll have at least some 4K broadcasting by that point. That is not going to be capable of coming down even some of the current fiber packages. I was looking at Sky's fiber packages. You know, the entry-level one has a 25 gig monthly usage allowance. Well, that's going to need to go entirely up to a maximum of 38 megabits per second. So that's a fraction of what fiber can currently do on, say, Virgin or even some of BT's wholesale packages. It currently goes up to a maximum of 76 megabit per second, which is certainly enough to stream 4K, but not multi-room, and certainly not if it was being used alongside, you know, somebody streaming Netflix in a bedroom or gaming in an office or, you know, anything else in another room. So something really quite drastic is going to have to change with Sky's internet packages too, all of which could be fantastically exciting from a competitive standpoint. And I'm extremely excited about this. It opens up so many doors. And, you know, I would not have Sky almost exclusively because I don't want a satellite dish.
I wondered if maybe Sky would restrict this to people who actually couldn't get a satellite dish.
No, they're not. They've said not. They've said it is for some people who can't, you know, but it is also people who won't.
Right. So because it's obviously going to cost them quite a bit of money to provision this kind of stuff. I wondered if maybe they might just try and go only for people who lived in, say, blocks of flats who had, you know, internet from them and stuff. You know, look, people who traditionally would struggle to get a good service on a satellite dish.
So, well, you're right. I mean, even in my previous flat where we used to live in Ealing, we rented and we weren't allowed to put up a satellite dish. So no matter how much we wanted Sky, contractually, we were, you know, restricted from doing it.
I know people don't like satellite dishes, and especially with things like Sky Q, having one dish that serves the whole block is actually fairly challenging technically. You wouldn't believe how hard it is actually to do. It shouldn't be, but it is.
Well, one thing before we just move away from talking about controversial and interesting topics involving satellite broadcasting systems, Ian, you wanted to mention a kerfuffle that's happening to people who may enjoy the Discovery channels.
I did. I mean, this is not super tech, but there is a tech angle that we'll come to at the end. And it's like any deal that any company has. Sky and Discovery work together, and Sky pays Discovery some money, and Discovery provides its channels. But recently, Discovery's been saying things like, we haven't had a pay rise since, you know, 2007 and stuff like that. And in real terms, the amount of money they're making has gone down, and they argue that their share of service has gone up. So there is a dispute between the two companies that is going to result in a couple of days, by the end of the month in fact, Discovery will withdraw its channels from Sky, so they will only be available on Virgin and I think BT, which is alarming if you're a Discovery viewer on Sky. And I think most of us are, because Discovery is, for some of its faults, still a pretty good channel.
So the tech angle to this is that you have a theory about what Discovery might do instead.
I think, you know, it depends how long this dispute goes on for, really. If it's true that Discovery's genuinely prepared to hold out for a certain amount of money and Sky is genuinely not prepared to give it to them, then I suspect they may have to explore other avenues. And again, as we've just discussed, delivering content over the internet is possible now. The BBC did it with BBC Three. They moved it off terrestrial and put it online only. So I suspect that maybe the future for Discovery will be its own streaming service. I think the friction with that comes from having to pay again. Sky is certainly not going to put its prices down when Discovery goes. So what do you do then? I mean, you're going to be paying the same amount for Sky and you're going to want Discovery. You have to pay extra for Discovery. It's going to be a difficult thing for viewers unless Discovery decides to sort of go, well, all right, then we'll be free and ad-funded. But I don't know if that's even possible with their model. So who knows? But they're certainly going to be cutting out a lot of their income if they're not going to be on Sky anymore.
I also have a theory about this don't think this is going to be the last time we hear of a discussion like this, because content providers are all too aware that their options for getting their content seen have never been so wide and have never widened so frequently. And so you look at a service like Netflix and you think, well, everything on Netflix is on demand. It's just all, you know, physical files stored on a server somewhere. It's not live. Well, what if in future, Netflix opened itself up to the option of having a live portion?
I'll tell you this, Nate. You don't even need to do live with Netflix because all you're doing is you're just replacing the traditional playout of a broadcaster. You could make it appear live, but it doesn't actually need to be live. It's just files stored and played out in a certain time. So you could do it. You could do it easily.
I wonder if that's actually not far away in our future. But
Sorry, I did interrupt you. I do wonder if Netflix is exploring the idea of becoming much more of a platform, because its infrastructure is very good and very clever, and I wonder if maybe it sees itself in the future as being something that provides a service to other smaller companies.
Lots here for you to give us your feedback on. Would you be prepared to ditch Virgin Media perhaps, or switch on Sky for the first time if it was delivered via internet alone? Let us know. podcast@natelangson.com. And it's at this point I should remind you that if you're not following us on @textmessagepod in the week, you're missing out on seeing all the news we're potentially going to talk about in the week at the weekend when we do the show. And you can let us know any opinions you have on those stories in advance. If you're in the UK and you have ever torrented TV shows or movies, then this next topic is going to be of interest to you, because we've learnt a little more this week about how you may be targeted by an anti-piracy campaign. Now, we've discussed this campaign before, but in a nutshell, it's a scheme called Get It Right from a Genuine Site, and it's specific to the UK. In fact, it's actually part funded by the government. It means copyright holders can send you letters via your ISP if they see you pirating content illegally online. Your name will go in a database and you'll be encouraged to take action to stop the activity. Now, that could be activity that you're knowingly conducting. It could be activity that your kids or a partner or even somebody using your Wi-Fi, if you leave it open, are doing. And that this may be a prompt to have the all-important sit-down conversation about piracy. Now, no legal action is going to be taken as part of this. This is all about education, and actually the messages you'll receive are officially called educational emails, but it is hoped that they will serve as a bit of a shock to the system to remind you that, yeah, you know what, you're not that anonymous and you can be identified, but also be mostly to encourage you to start acquiring content from legal sources rather than BitTorrent or similar. And although we've talked about this briefly before, we did learn a few more things this week. And specifically, what I thought was worth pointing out are the ISPs that are going to be involved in this initially as of this month. These include Virgin, Sky, TalkTalk, BT, but also PlusNet. These are all going to be involved in this. So if you're a customer of any of those networks, any of those providers, and you're BitTorrenting, then you're potentially, at least, a target of this. Now, they've said as well that they're going to send a maximum number of 2.5 million emails per year, and the program will stay active for a minimum of 3 years. But a couple of other things we learned this week. Number three is that you'll have a 20-day grace window, which is, 3 weeks. And that's a lot longer than what I read on Torrent Freak this week that the US has, which is about 7 days. So it basically means if you get caught doing this and you have an email, you'll go 20 days before being sent another one if you're seen to be doing it again. But if no further infringements happen on your account, that means no more letters. And after 12 months of no more letters, you will have your name cleared from this database. But the FAQ that was posted this week to the website did highlight that there's no blacklisting of customer accounts as such. So it's a very low, I don't say low risk, but low impact campaign. It's not going to report you to copyright officers and have legal bills thrust under your door. But it is going to be perhaps a bit of a wake-up call.
It's about education, isn't it? And I do support the idea that we can, we can educate people. And there are lots of reasons that people download things, off the internet, because they can, because they're interested in it, because they haven't got any money, blah, 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 blah. But at the same time, the more we educate people in, the number of jobs that are employed in creative industries and stuff like that, the more people think, I don't mind. I've said this a million times. It took me, quite a lot of years to get to the point where I have enough money to be able to afford to buy any media I pretty much want. I don't need to rely on torrents. I also have a huge amount of sympathy for, the people who are younger who don't, and I understand why they do what they do. But educating them will help, and then one day when they've got some money, they'll be happy to pay to acquire stuff. I have spent so much money on computer games recently. It is quite upsetting, but also good for the industry, right? And when I was younger, didn't used to pay for computer games. So they've built an audience in me that won't go away. So I think it's important, but it's good that the letter is a fairly light touch, I think.
It's one that makes me wonder whether this should be, taught in schools in some ways. My gut reaction is no, it's not the job of teachers to carry the anti-piracy message of lobbying groups. But at the same time, kids are growing up in an era of unrivaled on-demand access to anything they want. They've grown up in a culture of kind of, if it exists, then why can I not have it now? There are no reasons for this. And
that's
so
true.
It makes me think, is there some sort of middle ground somewhere that, we don't want this to be delivered by lobbyists, but maybe as part of kind of a general education about the internet, everything from social media to how to, not get yourself fired from a job by saying something stupid on Twitter when you're 16. Maybe this is the sort of thing that could be folded in a light touch way that maybe could help inform kids about, how companies make money and maybe how pirating it is destructive.
I've always felt this. I do feel like it's an ethical issue rather than and it shouldn't be a legal one. You're not stopping anyone from making money out of their product. Ultimately, if you steal something like a car or a hamburger, you've removed something, and then it can't be sold. Hollywood continues to be profitable. It continues to make films that are a success or not. I don't doubt there are financial challenges. I kind of feel like there is a lot of stuff that doesn't happen that should do. Like, going to the cinema is still not a brilliant experience. I went to see Rogue One before Christmas, and it was okay as an experience, but it was extremely expensive, and I still didn't feel like I was getting the kind of service I would be getting. I'd have rather watched that film at home.
Yes, we've had the same experience before. We rarely go to the cinema, but maybe once every couple of months. But the only reason that we will go is that through my company, we have a discount scheme where you can get 2-for-1 cinema tickets if you go in the week. So we do 2-for-1, and it works out about paying £7 or £8 per person, because a £15 ticket is...
It's still quite expensive if you think about it, isn't it? Like, it's not cheap to go to the cinema. And watching...
For an evening's entertainment, I'm not going to begrudge £8.
No, but it isn't an evening, is it? And you have to go through all that stress about booking a ticket, getting the right seat. I cannot go to cinemas and sit in the wrong seat. Nothing is more likely to irk me than being
Ian,
at the
what
front.
What cinema are you going to where they tell you what seat to sit in?
Well, you have to... If you want to go to a busy film, like a film that's, not like... been about to leave the cinema, you're competing with about 300 other people who all want the best seat in the house.
Oh.
So you have to book a seat, right? And I think all cinemas have allocated seating now. No one just does that thing where you run in at the start and sit in the best seat, do they?
To be honest, all the films we've seen recently have had like two people and a sad dog in it, and no one seems to mind or question why a dog's watching a film. But the fact is, it's very empty, so we can have pick of the seats. Well, let us note your thoughts to this. Obviously, you know, this is not a new topic. It's not one that we imagine we won't talk about again either in future. But in terms of how you think this sort of, I don't say war on torrenting, but the kind of educational side to what the industry's trying to do right now. What do you think? And are these letters worth it? Have you got one? If you have got one, then we definitely want to hear from you anonymously, if you wish. That would be fine. And whether it will actually have any effect on you, or if you can imagine receiving one, maybe if you have kids that are doing this, but you don't, if you can imagine receiving one, how would you treat that? You know, would you sit down and have a chat with whoever you think might be doing this? We'd love to know this. podcast@nateslangson.com. Well, over at Text Message Pod, had an interesting tweet come in from Gareth this week that reminded me of something I forgot to mention at the weekend last week when we were talking about driving through busy city places where the 4G doesn't work. And I said, actually, now it's sometimes better to drop down to SMS because there's so little activity on that network, thanks to WhatsApp and iMessage and the like, that you can use them actually very, very efficiently now. And he said, I've actually found that dropping back from 4G to 3G achieves a speedier connection because no one's on it. And I also did that at the weekend, and it did work. And, you know, 4G is technically faster, but if it's choked, it's slow. Whereas 3G, most phones are trying to get on the strongest signal, not the least congested signal. So 3G was much more efficient for me for sending photographs. So thank you, Gareth, for pointing that out.
Presumably that works if you go to America on 3 and you use Feel at Home, and everyone there will be on 4G while you would be on 3G because they don't do 4G roaming. It's an interesting little tip, that.
It absolutely is. And I don't know how this is achieved on Android, but I do know that if you ever find yourself in a predicament like this and you want to experiment with dropping down onto 3G, you can do in the settings menu, mobile data options, voice and data, and there's an option that says 4G, and you can drop it down to 3G or 2G. Although in my experience, dropping down to 2G as a way of sending texts is no more efficient than staying on a congested 4G network. It shouldn't be an option. It's pointless.
And I can tell you it is the same on Android. It's available on all phones.
One more story, news-wise, that we wanted to touch on briefly, only because I thought, because I didn't have much else I wanted to talk about this week. Tesco's mobile payment app, PayQuick, horrible name, capital P-A-Y, capital Q-W-I-Q.
Seriously, if this podcast wasn't marked as clean, I'd have some words to say about that.
Indeed, imagine those words, listeners, in your head. unless you're in school, as mentioned earlier, in which case, don't. Those are naughty words. Don't use those words. Anyway, PayQuick is now available in all Tesco supermarkets across the UK. Now, we almost talked about this story a few months ago when the trials were rolling out, because they trialed this in about 50 stores in London, Edinburgh. Then they extended it to about 500 stores, and I still didn't think it was worth talking about. And then this week, I decided it was worth talking about when I realised that on a contactless card, you can only spend about £30 per contactless transaction, whereas using this PayQuick thing, you can spend up to £250 in Tesco, because it puts like a QR code on your iPhone or your Android phone's screen, and you hold that against a little laser scanner at the checkout, and obviously you've linked your Tesco account with your bank account ahead of time, so it can just sort of debit that from your bank, so you can get around the contactless limit of low spends and spend, you know, a couple of hundred quid in one go. And they're rolling this out to all Tesco's everywhere in the country, so I think this is great. Mark Locke, who's the director of this initiative, said that apparently customer feedback has been very positive from their trials, and that's why they're rolling it out.
Do you really want to have another payment system on your phone?
Far from it, absolutely not. But at the same time, you can't use contactless for some payments. So if this is a way of having it as a backup, if you ever do spend more than £30 and you don't carry your cards around, maybe, because that's the habit that people are forming, certainly I am, then this is a good backup to have if you shop at Tesco. We don't have a Tesco near us. We have a Morrison's, a Sainsbury's, an Asda. You know, I'm going to stop naming supermarkets now. We don't have what I want, which is a Waitrose.
Waitrose. You've got to come to Surbiton for the Waitrose, mate.
Yeah. Be a hell of a drive for me to drive from Hertfordshire to Surbiton, made even longer by the fact that I can't drive.
Worth it. Totally worth learning, buying a car, getting down here. Worth it. There must be a Waitrose somewhere near you.
There is, but one of them is kind of a little Waitrose local thing in a petrol station, which is just not quite compelling enough to go to, and the other one's several miles away.
This has turned into a conversation that literally no one is interested in, hasn't it?
Yes.
I look forward to not hearing it in the final podcast.
If it makes it into the final edit, everybody...
I'll eat my shoes.
Yeah, it'll be a soul effort. Let's check in with Tom Merritt. Tom, what has been going on Daily Tech News Show this week?
Hey, thanks, Nate. This week on Daily Tech News Show, Allison Sheridan and I talked about why we say we saw news on Facebook or on Medium instead of referring to the publisher or the writer. We dug into the state of Hyperloop development, which, by the way, Europe has a chance to get first, discussed Facebook's change to deliver trending topics by region instead of tailored to each person, speculated what Dropcam's Greg Duffy could do now that he works for Apple, and discussed whether LG and Samsung's forthcoming phones will get us interested in phones again. All that and more coming up at dailytechnewsshow.com.
That's it, Ian. We're done. It's time for me to go and have another coffee. I'm going to cook some fish. Might even do chicken instead of fish. It's been a pleasure once again.
Thanks for the fully update, a really interesting in-depth dive into what you're planning on having for tea. I look forward to picking up with you later news of how that's gone, what the taste sensations were surrounding that food. Good chat.
I'll let you know. And listeners, we'll see you in a week. Groovy.
That has to go. There's so much in there that has to go.
And we can use those. We can incorporate them into the show. We're like the Mary Berry of podcasting. You know, we're just going to throw the ingredients out and you can help us mix them. And you can do that with a wooden spoon at @textmessagepod on Twitter. What a load of bollocks I just said.
I was wondering where you were going with any of that. It was fairly obscure.
I only usually think about three words ahead just as a way of not saying a lot. Yeah. So every now and again, stuff comes out and my mouth surprises my brain.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.